Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for coming this evening. My name is Christopher Coker. I am director of LSE Ideas, and it's my great pleasure to introduce our speakers this evening. Why are we here today talking about this? Richard Higgett, who is on my immediate left, will be addressing a report that he wrote for the Dialogue of Civilizations Institute in Berlin. And then the other speakers will be discussants, and then we'll have a Q&A. The reason we're here this evening is that culture has become an extremely important factor in international relations. And let me just go through five or six examples of that. President Putin last year saying that there was a civilizational chasm between Russia and the West. Not an ideological chasm or a political or an economic, but a civilizational. Viktor Orban in Hungary talking about how the European Union is now divided between what he calls a Christian European Union and a half-Islamic European Union, by which he means France and Germany. President Macron in France last year talking about a existential civilizational challenge from Africa. He's talking about the migration from the Sahel region for the next 20 or 30 years. The language is very interesting. Or Spain, the party leader of Vox, one of the populist movements, on a horse, dressed in armor, trying to recreate the idea of the Reconquista, the Spanish reconquest of Spain. Abe in Japan, probably the closest ally that Donald Trump has, who wants to reintroduce into Japanese school texts, a text that was banned by the American occupation authorities in 1945 about Japanese history. And in India, of course, we have Modi, and I'm sure you've been following that recently, the textbooks, history textbooks in Gujarat being rewritten to talk about the Muslim occupation of India. That's the Mughal period, which, of course, is one of the great periods of Indian history. And the fact that there is now the largest statue in the world is of a so-called Hindu resistance leader to Muslim occupation. So what we have, I think, is culture becoming an extremely important factor in the debate about where we go. It's very important in terms of the non-Western world pushing back against the West. It's very important in terms of what we call value pluralism. So a challenge to the idea that Western values are necessarily universal. And then, of course, there is, as you've seen from today, the civilization state, China and Russia. Vladimir Putin talked about Russia being a civilizational state, not a nation state, but a civilization state, back at the Valdai Conference in 2013. Xi Jinping talked about China being a civilization state, not a nation state, at the 19th Party Congress a couple of years ago. So we're here today to debate this. Richard Higgett, to my left, is from the Free University in Brussels. Julius Sen works for LSE Ideas as one of our program directors. Aaron McKeel, who has written about world order at some length, is also from LSE Ideas, runs the executive master's program that we provide. And then, we have Adrian Pabst from University of Kent, also head of department. So I hope we're going to have an interesting evening. The fact that we have so many people here on a Friday is indicative of the fact that you are interested, I think, in this concept. So, Richard, you will speak for 20 minutes, I think?
Yeah.
And then...
stop me after 20, okay?
I will. Thank you very much. And then we'll have 10 minutes from each of our discussants, and then we'll open it up for the Q&A. There will be a podcast. And the only other thing I have to say is that there will be an evaluation form at the end of this meeting. So please, if you would, fill that in. The evaluation forms are outside as you're going along. They're already been handed over. So, Richard, over to you.
Thank you. Thanks, Chris. They're very sneaky here. They put two glasses of Prosecco into me in the last 15 minutes.
Very civilized.
I was telling people it's 49 years since I graduated from this institution. Now, there aren't many good things about growing old, but one of them is that when you get to this stage, you're not looking for promotion, you're not looking for tenure, you're not writing for peer-reviewed journals. So if you're expecting a dispassionate exercise in value-free social science, you might as well leave now. This report that I was commissioned to write for the... Oh, how do I... There we go. This report that I was commissioned to write for this think tank in Berlin, The Dialogue of Civilizations, had quite a specific brief to it. It was to provide a state of the play on the problems of world order. It was to assess the obstacles to inhibiting reform of that order. And it was to do so on the basis of being accessible by educated lay people, not simply professors. So the slides that I'm going to present for you tonight, and you can access the report at this web page. Let me get that out of the way there. I don't know what that's doing there. Can we get rid of this? Oh, it's gone. There we go. There we go. I'm fine. So in about 20 minutes, I'm going to give you the guts of this this report. I start by identifying what I call three problematics of world order, which is a very dangerous thing to do. It's the kind of thing that you do at the end of the career, not the beginning of a career, when you need to be identified for your disciplinary expertise. I've long since stopped worrying about that. So these three problematics I identify for thinking about world order are the geostrategic, the geoeconomic, and to pick up on Chris's theme, the emerging geocultural and civilizational problematics. And I bring to bear in the report three different methodologies. Basically, the methodology of the student of international relations, the student of international political economy, and then I try to think a bit about culture and civilizations. But Adrian, who's on the far left of this table, no politics necessarily implied there, knows much more about this than I do. So they're the three things that I'm dealing with. And the report in brief deals with them in this way. Firstly, if we look at the changing nature of what I call political world order, then it's clear that we've never had a truly liberal or truly global order. Rather, it's, as Amitav Acharya would tell us, an American world order. And it was always only selectively liberal, and it was never totally global in terms of geographical coverage. And if the US, to the extent, was a hegemon, it was what I would call a self-binding hegemon. It bound itself when it chose to, not always as a matter of principle. Now, this order, as we all know in this room, is challenged more than any other time since 1945. And there are a range of explanations for that, and I'm not going to go through them, apart from to say that you can capture them under what we might call the impetus of a populist nationalist zeitgeist. The other thing that I want to do is get Trump out of the way as quickly as possible. He's a symptom, not a cause. He's an accelerator, not an instigator. But I do think it is important to talk about the end of a US liberal world order. And the challenges to it are fairly obvious. Rise of China, the behavior of Russia, the emergence of a new great game in the Asia-Pacific and now in Eurasia. And interestingly, it's about 115 years since Halford Mackinder first used the expression Eurasia. So that's the geopolitical order. The second thing that I look at, the second problematic, is what I call the international economic order. And this, of course, is in as much trouble as the political order. There are signs of economic deglobalization. There's much data on this. This is not to say that we're putting the globalization genie back in the bottle. We're not going to do that. But there is data to show deglobalization taking place. There's firstly a crisis in the international trade regime as a rules-based order, and global trade is exhibiting shrinkage. Secondly, the rise of protectionism since 2018 is really not a something that's happened quickly. It's over the last 12 or so years that we've seen this. And there's excellent work by a guy called Simon Evanett, who looks at what he calls the rise of murky protectionism over the last 12, 15 years. Thirdly, and I think this is important, is that the changing nature of the theory of comparative advantage that we've largely taken for granted since Ricardo wrote his Principles of Political Economy is giving way to a new mercantilism. And in the report, I have quite a big discussion of the elements of this new mercantilism. And yes, there are regional regroupings taking place. And again, global supply chains are too embedded, too complicated, too complex to unpack them or decouple them in the way the Americans want to. But nevertheless, they are under challenge. And we see what I call a shift from trade diplomacy to economic warfare. I wrote a piece about 18 months ago where I talked about the weaponization of trade. And I can't decide whether I'm pleased or sorry to see that everyone now talks about the weaponization of trade. But clearly, there's a shortening of time cycles in financial volatility. There's a prospect of currency wars growing. There is a battle over economic models. And, of course, there's a crisis of economic globalization, decline of institutions, particularly the WTO, and you'll all understand about the nature of the attacks on the appellate body of the WTO. And the WTO does need reform. There's no question about that. But we are backing away from multilateral collective action problem solving. And Robert Kagan has a very nice description of it where he says that jungles can grow back. We're unlearning 50 years of multilateralism. Now, the third element of it, and it's the element that I suspect most of you are here for tonight and the people like Adrian have expertise in, is the growth of what we call, or what I've called, a cultural civilizational contest between geopolitics and geoeconomics. And I borrowed the idea from the Armenian president of the rise of quantum politics, digital communication, social media, individualist online activity has revolutionized the nature of politics. Secondly, we're seeing the reassertion of the virtue of the civilizational state in the way that Chris mentioned it in his opening introductory remarks. And we're seeing the prospects of a quote-unquote new clash of civilizations. Huntington 2.0, for want of a better expression. Or as a Canadian friend of mine calls it, the rise of clashism, nurtured by narratives of irresponsibility. Since writing the report, I've come to think, or ask the question, do we need a fourth problematic, given the dramatic effects of digitalization on global order? And I talk about quantum politics, and if you walk into the LSE bookshop, the first book you see on the tables as you go through the door nowadays is, or today, this afternoon when I had a look, is Shoshana Zuboff's Surveillance Capitalism, where she identifies the manner in which the digital utopians view that we will be set free has not occurred, and as you all know as well as I do, human experience is being monetized as behavioral data becomes more ubiquitous and accessible. And all of this has attendant massive implications for government attitudes towards politics, cultural expression, particularly at the international level. Now, the major issue that I deal with in the report, it's not the only issue, but it's the major issue, is the escalation of the US-China conflict and the prospects for a new Cold War. And this has gone from being a simple Trumpian view of unequal trade imbalances and tariffs and protectionism to wider economic warfare. Trade imbalances are second-order problems. The big-ticket items, growing competition for global ascendancy in high-tech, digital, artificial intelligence, cybersecurity. Nothing very original in this report, apart from, I think, the way I've managed to bring things together. But there is also the idea of a civilizational clash in the making. And many of you may recall Kieran Skinner, a US State Department person in 2018, distinguishing between the Cold War against Russia, which she used, and I use her words, was a fight within the Western family, and the growing clash with China, which was the first great power competition that was not Caucasian. And Trump himself was quoted as saying, the West will never be broken. It's the first time I've ever cited a tweet in a paper. Our values will prevail. Our civilization will triumph. This is the language of clashism. Competitors and allies alike are identified as free riders. Trump talks about Europe as being as bad as China. He uses the language of make America great again, as you all know. And he uses expressions like trade wars are easy. Now, what this did, this analysis of these three problematics, geoeconomic, geopolitical, geocultural, it led me to ask the question, what kind of visions of world order do we have on the back of those explanations? And I identified four different views. The US is clearly what I would call economically revisionist, but politically status quo. The US is coping badly with its declining global status, much of which is self-inflicted, of course. It wants bilateral, transactional, and a mercantilist economic world order, but a political status quo. China, on the other hand, and India too, are what I call economically status quo powers, but politically revisionist powers. They reverse the US view of the world. They've benefited massively from economic globalization. They're invested in reform, not necessarily the kind of reform that the US would want to see, but they do not want to overthrow the existing international order. They basically want to reform it so that it suits their image better. They want to remove past humiliations, whether it's open wars, imperialism, no more of that. But they want recognition of their great power status and their role in global decision making. And so clearly, the activities of the last few years, the AIIB, the New Development Bank, Belt and Road Initiative, all that fits that kind of activity. Russia, I identify as being politically revisionist, but economically less significant. It's less a beneficiary of globalization. It's less economically and politically invested in the system. It's a spoiler, seeking restitution of prestige and its own sphere of influence. Now, these are gross generalizations. This really is a helicopter view of things. And Europe, of course, still has a lingering love for the multilateral order that never was. But if you watched the speeches of van der Leyen and Josep Borrell over the last 4 or 5 weeks, they're starting to use what I call the hairy-chested language of geopolitics. They want to talk about a geopolitical commission. They talk about that they've been a soft touch in the past. This, I think, is destined for disaster, but that's something we can talk about later. Again, I don't normally cite Henry Kissinger, but his description of Trump as just the end of an era is good, I think. And so I suggest to you that you place your new world orders here. And I've got five competing views of a future world order. One is partially liberal, but post-hegemonic. And it's found in the works of writers like Eikenbury and Dewdney and that whole bunch of US liberal scholars. In this context, reform is negotiable. Some accommodation with Chinese interests is possible, but definitely required. Secondly, of course, we've got this nationalist, competitive, great power order vision of the world. And this is US realists, Mearsheimer, Walt, Kaplan, and Allison with his rearview mirror analysis of Thucydides and his trap. In this context, negotiated reform is unlikely in an era of hyper-realism, and particularly in an era of strongman politics. Thirdly, we've got what we might call a multiplex world order. This is a Charia and some English school types. Reform... I'm sorry. I know Barry is not in the room, so. Here, what we see is a prospect of reform being negotiable, but consolidating in manageable regional structures, transatlantic, Asia-Pacific, Eurasia, for example. A Charia is pretty forceful on this. Fourthly, there are those people who see the emergence of an Asian, China-dominated world order. Again, former LSE professor Danny Kwa, now at the Lee Kuan Yew School, Kishore Mahbubani, his predecessor, Parag Khanna, they all write about the growth of an Asian-dominated world order. And trend data says yes, but question marks over the attractiveness of the Chinese model will remain and will probably get more severe over the next few months as well. And finally, and I offer this as by way of a provocation, and this is for Chris and Adrian to have a go at, the emergence of a multi-civilizational world order, where we see irreconcilable ideological standoff, contest, polarization, and unlikely probabilities for reform. Now, because I had to write this report and I had to come up with some positive recommendations at the end, I had to pose the question, can a dialogue of civilizations be a negotiating agenda for world order? And I'm afraid I was a bit more skeptical about this than the people who were funding my consultancy would have liked. So what I identify in the report are obstacles to dialogue on world order reform. Negative impact of quantum politics, negative impact of enhanced civilizational and cultural differences, enhanced conflict and coercion at the expense of consensus cooperation. And particularly here, I just finished a big 3-year project for the European Union on cultural diplomacy. And the principal result that we get from this report is substantial decline in diplomacy as both an institution and a set of practices. A decline in multilateral institutions as venues for collective action decision-making. Clearly, growing disillusionment with liberal democracy as an instrument of voice. And again, you've only got to go in the LSE bookshop, and books like that fall off the shelves at you nowadays. And, of course, the dominant role in international politics of strongman leaders. And they are all men. Xi Jinping, Putin, Modi, Orban, Erdogan, Bolsonaro, Netanyahu, Bin Salman, Duterte, etc. And those what I call the democratically constrained wannabe strongmen, such as Trump and Johnson. Although Trump is now less constrained than Johnson, I think. And, of course, a dialogue excluding 50% of the world's population plus is inevitably going to be limited. So I just find this a difficult question to answer in the affirmative. So I use that well-worn expression, what is to be done? And what I identify, and again, it's not original, but it's quite obvious, is we don't have narratives or meta-narratives of culture and civilization to deal with global cooperation. Narratives of culture and civilization operate at national levels, not at global levels. Our capacity for cooperation, let alone building global civilization beyond the states, simply not there. And what I try to offer some suggestions as a way of justifying my fee. And I say we need a system of cross-cultural discursive and negotiating practices that operate across multi-levels to dialogue civilization. I also say, and this may generate some interest or irritation, international relations scholarship and practice needs innovative, forward-looking things. I spent many years being skeptical when I was a pro vice chancellor with a jurisdiction over the Warwick Business School. I used to hate the word innovation. All professors of management used to talk about innovation. But I've now read some of the innovation literature on organizations. And quite frankly, if students of international relations would stop looking in the rearview mirror at wars between Sparta Athens, and started thinking in terms of innovation, if they used behavioral psychology, then we may be able to actually think about different ways of organizational behavior. So the report that I produced was seen as a beginning, not an end, about thinking about the dialogue between civilizations. The think tank, the Dialogue of Civilizations Research Institute, it's genuinely committed to trying to create dialogue. It's not getting very far, but it's identified this as a very important issue. But of course, if I was Bill Clinton, I'd say it's people, stupid, because it's people that negotiate, not civilizations. The concept of civilization is a social and cultural representation. We need to develop storylines of what we might call civilization speak. We need to allocate or decide who allocates the rights and duties to speak about civilization. Who has the power to start, take part in, and conclude dialogues? Because many groups, organizations, are not part of this process. And dialogue, I actually see as a, and this is where I'm uncomfortable because I'm not strong in humanities and these kinds of areas. But dialogue, it seems to me, is a moral field that comprises different moral orders, cultural, state and institutional, conversational, and individual moral orders. And I think if we're to take this to the next stage, that's the area for, where the younger generation who are interested in culture and civilization need to work, what I call old white European men like me. I'm heading off into the sunset. Chris, thank you. Oh, I'm not pessimistic.
Anyway, as you know, Dwem's dead white European males has been replaced by Weird's Western educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. So that's what you are. You're Weird, but you're not a Dwem.
Not yet.
You're heading in that direction, but you're not got there yet. Thank you very much for that. Dialogue, yes, it's Tom Stoppard said the reason I write plays, which are dialogues, is to contradict myself. And I think that's the most important thing to say.
And you think I've contradicted myself?
Of course, yes, but I didn't want to expose you to the... Can I just ask just two things just to help people in the audience who do not know what the English school is and perhaps don't know what the Thucydides trap is. It's very interesting you forgot that Athens was part of the war. You remember that Sparta was.
But that
may have betrayed you.
Yes,
well, quite. So could you just say something about the Thucydides trap and also the English school, just before I ask Julius to speak?
Okay. Colleague of Chris's, someone I've known and liked for many, many years, emeritus professor at LSE, Barry Buzan, of course, is principal protagonist of the English school. And they have a view of world society that's reflected in Acharya's idea that some kind of accommodation is possible. The Thucydides trap has been around for a long time, since Thucydides wrote about the wars between Athens and Sparta, and the idea that a rising power will lead the dominant power to respond, and it very often leads to war. This has been picked up again in the last couple of years by Graham Allison, American political scientist, former dean of the Kennedy School at Harvard, and he suggested that the best analogy to think about the growing relationship between the US and China is to use the Thucydides trap view of Athens and Sparta as rising power and the inevitable lead towards conflict. That do?
That will do very well. Thank you very much. Every American president used to refer to Thucydides in his speeches, except for George Herbert Bush, who had difficulty pronouncing the name.
Thucydides.
Thucydides, absolutely. And then his son, of course, you'd never actually heard of him. But if you snort that amount of coke at the Skull and Bone Club in Yale, that's what's going to happen to you. Sorry, are there Yale people in this audience? I sincerely hope not. Right, well, thank you very much for the clarification. And now we will move over to our three speakers over here, one after the other. Julius, please. And you do
up.
Need... Because yes,
I'm
no, please get up, yes.
Quite small and no one can see me.
That's my rationale as well.
Thank you very much.
Hold on. Can you hear me? Can you see me? Anyway, is it working?
Apparently not.
It is. Yes, because yours
I think it is. It is. It's not showing up.
The light.
Thank you very much, Christopher. And Richard, thank you very much for introducing the topic. I will, if I may, confine my response or reflections to one element of what Richard had raised, and that is about the geo-economic dimension to this whole thing. Before I start, can I just ask how many of you are dealing with trade policy or international economic institutions? Very interesting. Very few, I should say, and interesting. Please, for those of you who don't have familiarity with trade or international economic institutions, please forgive me for walking you through my discussion and debate. I'm trying to get at a particular point, and the point, of course, I will highlight towards the end. So, as I said, I will actually confine myself to reflections on the role of trade within the international economic order and leave it open as to how it fits with Professor Higgert's framework, or where perhaps we need to rethink some of its elements about the liberal economic or international order. On the face of it, everything looks relatively simple. The Atlantic Charter frames a post-war process, which is then played out in succeeding years. The UN system is created, along with Bretton Woods institutions. Decolonization gathers pace, and the world depends heavily on the principles and processes contained within these new systems and institutions. To complete the transition from war to peace, to restore growth, and to coordinate policy endeavors in trade, health, hunger reduction, etc. The concept of the indivisibility of peace is finally engaged, and global economic recovery gathers pace. Things are looking up. We're talking about the immediate aftermath of the Second World War. But this arrangement left many issues unresolved, particularly in economic policymaking, which are actually very difficult to explain and categorize, especially when considering what liberalism means. Let me focus for a moment on some aspects of this situation to explain further what I mean. We often forget, but we need to bear in mind at the outset that the Articles of Agreement of the IMF and the World Bank make absolutely no mention of free trade or economic liberalism. Their objective was to restore economic growth and provide a platform for post-war stability. Domestic economic policy was thus left to each country to decide on its own, and many chose a mix of state and market-led recovery and growth models, often supported by the World Bank. Indeed, many of these models required central planning as a precondition to World Bank funding. American references to free trade, which are after all critical to the whole way we think about things, are perhaps best understood as free to trade, which various colonial and imperial systems actually prevented. They were not particularly concerned with tariffs and regulations if they could access markets around the world. They also recognized that free to trade provisions eliminated the need for captive sources of raw materials and markets. In other words, colonies. At the same time, an international trade organization was contemplated, which did indeed aim to liberalize trade and investment, but which never came into existence, as it was blocked by the U.S. Congress, mainly because of a lack of reciprocity from other countries. Opponents to reciprocity included U.S. allies in Europe, developing and colonial administrations, and of course the entire communist bloc, who also didn't join the IMF or the World Bank. The U.S. was therefore almost alone in this situation. What remained in institutional terms was GATT, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, for those of you who deal with trade, also known as the General Agreement to Talk and Talk. Itself a U.S. initiative, but GATT participation was taken up by only 24 countries. In 1945, there were 51 members of the United Nations. Half, approximately, signed up to this very limited arrangement. Following on from this hesitant start, in 1955, the U.S. was granted a waiver, an exemption, from GATT provisions relating to agriculture, mainly to protect domestic subsidies and to preserve import restrictions. By extension, this applied to everybody. To be sure, this was supported in many other parts of the world and provided the basis for the CAP, for example. Food security was now a legitimate exception to the idea of free trade. And when considered in the context of post-colonial development priorities, led on to the idea of broader exclusions. From 1964 onwards, reciprocal trade obligations for all developing countries, which covered most countries in the world at the time, were dropped altogether. The WTO, which succeeded GATT in 1995, did indeed reintegrate agriculture and developing countries into the multilateral system, while also extending coverage to services. But the agreements on agriculture and services were extremely weak, and still remain so, even though services represents 70 to 80% of economic activity in advanced economies, including the United States. Agricultural sensitivities relate mainly to protecting massive domestic subsidies in advanced economies and fragile subsistence agriculture in developing countries, which almost everyone, but not everyone, accepts. So agriculture remains largely out. So consider this situation. We have a liberal international economic instinct pushed by the United States, but it excludes services and excludes agriculture to a large extent. We then need to consider other exemptions. Against the three principles that the GATT-WTO arrangement attempts to promote or advance, we find more than 30 exceptions and exemptions, including national security. While most exceptions are subject to some rules, national security is not. Sovereign states determine their own security priorities. Everything Trump does is with reference to national security priorities. These exceptions have often been used by WTO members to protect domestic interests against international competition. In fact, this is the policy instrument of choice of the U.S. in the current round of trade wars. Everything is couched in terms of national security. But they are not the only ones. If you recall, France protected Danone, the yogurt makers, on similar grounds of national security. So what we have in effect is a very mercantilist system. Nothing liberal about it. To be sure, we use mercantilist mechanisms to reduce trade barriers. Leading on, it is hoped, to greater space for markets to operate. But this hardly conforms with liberal economic precepts. You actually need trade barriers as leverage to reduce the trade barriers of other countries. Of course, and this is the big question, countries are free to eliminate all tariffs and regulatory barriers on their own. But not a single country in the world has done so. One important variant to this whole debate about how should we deal with global trade, but which actually had a very short lifespan, was the New International Economic Order, NIEO. I don't know if you're familiar with this. Which in effect sought to replicate the effectiveness of the cartel process created by OPEC. This came closer to succeeding than people realize, and had widespread developing country and European support. It unraveled rapidly with the onset of the global debt crisis in the early 1980s, when many of its ardent supporters had to ask the IMF for financing and debt restructuring. By this stage, we need to remember the IMF had developed its own free market agenda at variance with its articles of agreement. Interestingly, it was only really from within the NIEO, the New International Economic Order debate, that alternative worldviews were considered that related to economic policy and trade, and which, if taken to their logical conclusion, would have separated the ideas of economic liberalism from political liberalism. But even in this debate, the focus was on improving the material benefits of the trading system, terms of trade, rather than on their wider impact on concepts of liberalism. In today's world, elements of this debate rumble on within a broader discussion on the nature and substance of what constitutes development, but with insufficient clarity or definition, particularly in the context of climate change, demographic pressures, and resource shortages. The policy preferences of emerging economies are still expressed in terms of doing better within existing arrangements than in terms of applying new values and ideas, or to reshaping the wider system. In doing so, they tend to identify with the values that underpin the present system, especially as these relate to managing the global agenda through a consensus-driven approach. Before I conclude, just to feed two additional important elements into this debate. International trade, WTO and GATT, is only about one-third of global economic activity. The bulk of everything that happens is still national and local. To be sure, economies are now more exposed to international trade and investment trends, but this only makes governments more defensive, not less. We just need to look at the way Chinese and Russian investment activity is blocked, is considered. Most economic policy is thus still national, and most economic models combine state and market features. There are no pure free market or liberal systems in existence at all. The second point is a bit harder to grasp because none of us have a firm handle on the data. 20 to 25% of all global economic activity is either in the informal sector or in shades of black or gray. In material terms, this represents activity that is about the size of the US economy. About $20 trillion of global activity is not controlled by anybody. It operates outside anyone's real control, and if anything is really free market, it is this. But I'm not sure that this is what was meant by economic liberalism. So what does this all tell us about US leadership and economic liberalism? Not a lot, perhaps, because the interplay of initiatives, agendas, preferences, and outcomes are much too complex to draw simplistic conclusions. Also, the current state of play is creating confusion. While Trump's agenda looks transparently mercantilist, the wider response is also mercantilist, whilst using free trade rhetoric to justify policy positions. So we are perhaps left to reflect on the direction of travel to get a sense of how economic liberalism is going. Most people think it is going backwards. Indeed, Richard pointed to this. And globalization is unraveling. And global identity is fragmenting. Perhaps this is something my colleagues can better answer, but looked at from the narrow perspective of trade, it's always been mercantilist, and the mercantilist mechanisms remain firmly in place. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Right.
I have apologies to the podcast. I have our apologies.
Right. My first slide is blank. All right. It hasn't been mentioned on the podcast, but this is a full house. Thank you, everyone, for attending this evening. I'm very glad to be here. I've been tasked with talking about the concept of order and world order, having waves in the back. In general, I want to say a few nice things about this report first. Reading it for the second time, I enjoyed it even more than the first time. The first thing that I want to compliment about it is, indeed, you mentioned it yourself, the comprehensiveness of this report. It's quite a task to deal with cultural politics, economic politics, security politics, and so on, and project that into the unknown future, being an added twist on the task. Moreover, it's relatively succinct. So I recommend you all take your time to peruse it at your leisure. Now, if I want to focus on order, there's a couple key questions I want to focus on. What kind of world order are we going to be experiencing, constructing, or generally enduring in the 21st century, and how much order will there be? How orderly will it be? These are the key questions. I think Professor Higget laid out the debate quite clearly and the major positions in that debate. Page 58, you can see it on my PowerPoint. You can't see it on the podcast. But it's my favorite page in the entire report. It lays out the different possible scenarios for our near but not long-term future, which lays out the different scenarios which you laid out in your discussion. A highly conflictual one, a kind of new Orwellian or Mearsheimer world, something slightly more endurable than that, blockism, regionalist type of order, but not in an integrated one, an integrated regionalism, or some sort of globalist world order that I think you suggest is highly unlikely, but nonetheless desirable. These questions about what kind of world order and how much world order, I think, in this report are mostly about cultural politics. My previous speaker spoke about international political economy. For me, this is about cultural politics at a global level. We have cultural politics in our daily lives. We have cultural politics in our national lives and our regional lives. At a global level, it becomes geopolitical. We have cultural politics at a global level. Rising powers are trying to legitimate their new authority, their new sway in the international system by calling upon civilizational legitimacy, by re-legitimizing themselves as distinct and distinguished civilizations. They want to legitimate their status in the international system to gain more say, more sway, and justify the type of rules that they wish to project. What is at stake in this debate, I think, is the terms of global cultural diversity at a global level. This is what is at stake, and from my perspective. The recent book by Christian Roy Schmidt, I think, is quite helpful in this. This is on my PowerPoint slide for the podcast, on cultural diversity, an LSE publication. This is a concept for understanding ways in which international systems organize cultural diversity. The understanding here with this concept, the point of this concept, is that we're reorganizing the terms on which cultural diversity is organized in the 21st century. What kind of rules apply? What kind of cultural sources of authority are legitimate? This is what is at stake in this talk of civilizations and civilization states. Where is it heading? What kind of world order does this suggest? I found myself in the middle of the road on our spectrum of possible futures. I very much agree with the report, more or less, though I have my language, which I adopt from Buzan and Acaria. The idea of a deep pluralist world order means a culturally pluralist world order, not a liberal pluralist world order, but a more profoundly pluralist world order, a deep pluralist world order. This is the kind of future that we are discussing when we talk about civilizational states and clashes of civilizations and civilizational discourse in general. Buzan and Acaria give us this definition, which is on the PowerPoint, which you can find elsewhere. I won't read it. But the nice thing about this analysis that Buzan and Acaria give us is that they give us they parse the middle road in more precise ways. We can have a contested versus an embedded deep pluralist future. A contested deep pluralist future is one in which civilizational discourse is oppositional, as it were, where my rules are my rules and your rules are your rules, and frankly, they're going to conflict whether we like it or not. This is a contested type of outlook where there may be space and place involved as well, but there's certainly a lot of security and economic concerns at stake. An embedded deep pluralist world order is quite different. This language goes back to Ruggie. This is a constructivist language. The idea there would be that the rules in principle would be pluralist, where the rule of the road would inherently be pluralist. So it would be kind of an accepted feature or characteristic of the system that pluralism is the way. I'm having a kind of shortage of language about it, but I think an embedded, deep pluralist world order would be more preferable than a contested one. A contested one can slip into this notions of clashism and deliberate contest, rather than trying to find rules in which we can agree that they're pluralist and have multiple interpretations of them. These are the two kind of features that they give us in this conceptual language, which I think is the way in which cultural politics is going. Now, between the two, on balance, as a projection, not a prediction, as it were, right, as a trajectory, a contested world order, a contested pluralist world order, seems more in the cards than a deep pluralist embedded world order. Why? Because I think there's a number of stresses that the international system is under, which will induce state leadership to find their own self-interested policies before common benefit foreign policies and cooperation. Firstly, there is the great gap in this report, which you identify, which might be in report number 2, which is climate change. States will be increasingly under the stresses of climate change in the next few decades. A 2 to 3 degree of global warming world will be in which, where states are necessarily having to look out for their own territorial integrity, their own populations. They will have to prioritize themselves first. They will perhaps seek to help each other in global ways, but I highly doubt it. I highly doubt it. When Shanghai and New York are underwater, I think states will be looking out for themselves. We have persistent inequality, and we have a global cultural backlash against globalism. It's very difficult to develop a globalist integrated world order where we have embedded pluralism when there's a global populist nationalist movement against global structures. Doesn't seem likely to me. Lastly, the one we're most familiar with is the so-called trap, the pitfall Thucydides has been identified as identifying great power politics and power shift. This creates stresses on the system because it creates anxieties amongst security decisions. States are increasingly fearful of rising and declining powers. Areas in which powers used to provide order are receding. There's power vacuums. We have a global power shift. You might measure it in a very rapid way. You might measure it in a very long-term way, but it is underway. The anxieties of power shift are not conducive to global cooperation. That's the whole point of the idea. They're conducive to conflict, fear, and insecurity. So this will induce state leaders to make self-interested decisions, create self-interested uses of cultural politics on a global scale. This is a projection, not a prediction, if I have to qualify again. All right. Overall, I think we might see 2 recommendations that we could see in a report, volume 2. One would be, when we talk about civilizational states and civilizational discourse, states leaders use this language. Right? And I think there's responsible and irresponsible ways of using this discourse. I had a transcript from a meeting between Xi and Modi in November. There was a summit. Yes. And so this transcript, they speak of ancient and profound civilizations that can provide inspiration for solving various challenges facing the world. I think that sounds great, doesn't it? Right? That sounds fantastic. Right? So this seems a nice, helpful way to think about civilizations, or talk about it more precisely. But there is a fear of talking about civilizations as discrete and some being superior to others, or distinct things that have an equivalency to nationalism. Civilizationalism as a new form of nationalism would be a very nasty and problematic thing at a global level. And I think we need to avoid that type of irresponsible usage of this big idea. A more responsible way would not only be about meeting between and cooperation between ancient and distinct and important civilizations, but also the pursuit of a common global civilization to which we all aspire, in which these big and important civilizations are nonetheless nested. There is an irresponsible and a responsible way of using this language. That's the end of my talk. Have a go over time. Thank you very much for your patience.
Thank you very much, Christopher. I shall remain seated. I think I have no slides to show. I'm not... going to rise to the lectern, but let me start by a phrase that Richard used towards the end of his presentation, which is "What is to be done?" Of course, a phrase he took from Lenin, and there's something else Lenin said that I think resonates perhaps even more than that one, and it's this. He said, there are decades where nothing happens, and there are weeks where decades happen. And I think that is probably something that captures very much the moment in which we find ourselves. But then immediately raised the question of what exactly this era is that we are living in. It has been, you know, described almost universally as an era of change. But perhaps it's less that than a change of era. And by the way, that is something that Pope Francis said, which I think is interesting. And that change of era was perhaps first conceptualized by Gramsci. And I'm not endorsing Gramsci. I just think some of Gramsci's concepts here are useful. And of course, Gramsci had two of them, which I think are apposite. One is the interregnum, the idea that there is an end of hegemony. And I think that is very much where we are. It's the end of a certain hegemony, whether it's a certain American-led order or perhaps the liberal world order, or even more fundamentally, some sort of order around the Atlantic world, the last 500 years, right, since the discovery of the Americas, the Reformation, and everything we've seen that is, I think, underpinning Western hegemony roughly since 1492. And of course, 1492 was only 50 years after the end of Constantinople, so the whole collapse of what was the Eastern Roman Empire in the East. And the reason why I think all of this is relevant is because it raises the question of whether we're perhaps moving not so much into an Asian century or even more specifically a Chinese one, but rather perhaps a reversion to something like a Eurasian century. The idea that actually power is shifting back to, as Richard mentioned in his presentation, Mackinder's idea that actually the Eurasian heartland is perhaps more central to global geopolitics than the Atlantic world. But let me just stick with Gramsci for one moment, because the other idea that Gramsci put forward that I think captures where we are is what happens in interregnum. In an interregnum where there is no hegemony, where there is no absolutely dominant power, there is what he calls a war of position. And a war of position is different from a war of movement. A war of movement is basically trying to align all your various forces according to a set paradigm. In a war of position, everything is at stake. Ideas, leadership, organization. And I think this is perhaps closer to where we are. It's a war of position. It's a war of position, I think, that is very much to do the things that Richard mentions in his report. And the reason why we need to go further than the kind of dominant narratives is because the three narratives since 1989 simply do not account for where we are. What are those three narratives? They're the end of history, and I don't have to go over what that means and why it doesn't quite capture where we are. Globalization, the other big narrative, right? In large part developed by the late David Held, professor in, you know, in this house. And then, of course, Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilization. But of those three narratives, I would submit, it's not so much the end of history and globalization that explains where we are today. I think Huntington, though wrong in many respects, probably got it more right than the other two. Now, I don't think that Huntington is correct in terms of how he defines civilization and whether he's right in pitting the West against Islam and other civilizations. But I think Huntington put his finger on something fundamental, which is that culture and civilization are never absent from geopolitics. And more fundamentally, they are, in some sense, what Christopher, in his book, The Rise of Civilization, calls the currency of international relations. They're very much the language that underpins much of what's going on in either economic, political, or indeed in cultural terms. And this is where Richard's report is so important. Because Richard does not go for any of those three narratives. And crucially, he, I think very successfully, challenges both old opposites and new binaries. Richard's report does not go about, you know, endlessly on about East and West. Sort of a continuation of the Cold War narrative. He doesn't talk about left and right. He doesn't talk about state and market. These are all fairly artificial constructs. Nor does he go for new binaries like open versus closed society, right? Something that Karl Popper, again, of this house might have said, or George Soros might say today, and a lot of muscular liberals go on about. Or something like the new network generation versus the old left behind. These are all very crude dualisms that simply do not capture where we are. The great strength, the great merit of Richard's report, I think, is that he weaves together the political, economic, and cultural factors into, I think, a much better narrative. And it's a narrative that essentially asks the question of identity, of belonging. It asks the question of who are we? And interestingly, that is the question that Huntington asked himself about the United States. And who are we is the big question of our time, because I don't think any civilization, whether in its cultural form or as a civilizational state, is quite on the money, if you forgive that phrase, because I think all civilizations today are in disarray. They're not really asking the more fundamental question of what makes us human. So you look at contemporary China, and I don't mean the Chinese people, I mean the Chinese leadership. You have Leninist state capitalism allied to some form of tech totalitarian control. Now, that is not reflective of the rich diversity of Chinese civilization going back millennia. Then you add some sort of neo-Confucian discourse about global harmony that, frankly, is not reflective of the Confucian tradition at all. It is essentially a form of propaganda now exported through the Confucian institutes, but not reflective of what Confucius actually taught. And I'll come back to that in a minute. In Russia, you have a discourse around, we're neither European nor Asian, we're Eurasian. But really, what it is a sort of gangster czarism couched in sort of orthodox, pious terms. Again, no reflection of the richness of Russian culture. I'm married to a Muscovite, so I have some sense of the tension between the older and the newer Russia. And in India, you have a dominant rhetoric around Hindu nationalism that excludes other parts of the country, mostly the Muslim minority, when, of course, India, among many other things, was always a coexistence of many nations, many faiths, and nothing that could be essentialized in terms of a Hindu-dominated narrative at all. And then I think in the West, it's perhaps even more stark, because you've got cosmopolitanism. You might say the EU is a reflection of that. And you've got nativism in parts of Europe, but also in America. And you've got a more fundamental tension in the West between what is essentially a political civilization, right? Going back to 1941 and the Atlantic Charter. Again, Christopher's book on the rise of civilization still charts this very well. And I think that political civilization is not the same as the West as a, if you like, cultural civilization, as as something which essentially inherits not only the biblical tradition, but also ancient Greek and Roman philosophy and law, but of course also Europe being itself a crucible of civilizations, inheriting a lot from Babylonia, inheriting a lot from the Indo-European tradition, and not really being something that you can essentialized, that you can capture in some sort of foundational moment. So Europe, and you might say the West, is much more of a crucible of civilizations as a single civilizational entity. And because all these different countries are in disarray about what they really represent, I think we are not having a meaningful dialogue of civilizations. Because you can't have a dialogue of civilizations unless you actually have a certain sense of who you are, of where you come from, what your history is, and what that might mean for today and for the future. And I think one of the things that all the civilizations that are supposedly in dialogue are forgetting is some of the things they do share in common, despite a lot of difference in diversity. And that can be, I think, conceptualized in the way that Carl Jaspers did in a book in 1946, where he spoke of the Axial Age, that period of 800 to 200 BC, roughly the period where essentially different traditions converged around two important notions. One was the dignity of the person, the irreducible, intrinsic worth of each and every person, male or female, young or old, beyond class, color, and creed. And that is a fundamental civilizational achievement that you find in Buddhism, in Confucianism, in Judaism, in Socratic and Platonic philosophy, and so on. And allied with that fundamental recognition of the dignity of the person is that idea that actually there's no such thing as an opposition of the gods and humanity. You know, the idea that somehow the gods are angry and keep on punishing humanity for all its faults, but actually that something like the divine, the transcendent, can be allied to the human. Again, you find that in the teachings of Confucius, Buddha, Plato, Judaism, and later on Christianity. And I think it's more helpful to remember that shared heritage of the actual age, because that will be a common ground, a common lexicon or grammar for civilizations to have a more meaningful dialogue than any contemporary language just couched in terms of human rights or democracy or any of those concepts, which, while very important, are, I think, ultimately secondary. There is no point in talking about human rights or democracy or the rule of law unless you have a sense of the dignity of the person and the fact that the human and the divine are not necessarily opposed. Now, I think where we are today in political terms is also, you know, something that Alan Bloom captured in an American context when he talked about the closing of the American mind. I think there's a lot of that going on. But I will finish on this, which is, I may not be optimistic that this dialogue of civilization will happen or will be a success, but I do remain hopeful that it could happen, because ultimately I think a lot of contemporary ideology or sectional interest is not ingrained with reality, with the fundamental anthropological and cultural reality of what human beings desire. And human beings do not desire primarily abstract wealth or domination over others. Human beings fundamentally desire recognition. They want to be recognized for who they are, for all their talents, but also they want to be forgiven for their faults. And I think a dialogue around recognition and reciprocity is going to be a lot more helpful than the dialogue conducted on purely Western terms or Asian terms or Eurasian terms. So perhaps we are in an age where it's not so much the change of that is prevalent, but a change of era, and one where perhaps some of the more fundamental anthropological and ethical questions are coming to the fore again. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much to all our speakers. Who Are We sounded a bit like Huawei at some point, and perhaps the algorithms will decide whether civilizations are important or not. We don't have that much time, unfortunately, for question and answer, but what I would like to seize this opportunity in the 50 minutes that we do have is to ask you to ask some questions. So who would like to be the first to come forward? I know it's a Friday afternoon or Friday evening, and we're all half asleep, but yes.
Aliyar Salam Pasha, University of Oxford. My question is for Professor Higgett. Thank you so much for your speech. You put forward five distinct world orders, and my question is, do you consider them mutually exclusive absolutes, or do you consider them... Or do you consider them...
You're obviously a person who thinks there's a microphone in front of you at all times, but that's fine.
There I would like to
now.
Think that. Yes. Or do you think that they can exist simultaneously, like blockism or clash of civilizations or dialogue of civilizations can happen at the same time in different parts of the world?
I think that can be extended to Aaron as well, who was looking at that.
Absolutely.
Let's have two more questions. Yeah, very
Thank
convenient.
Thank you very much. It was a great privilege for us to be here. I have a question. When we're speaking about the idea of civilization, it is highly connected conceptually with the idea of empire. And when we're speaking about two points, that empires are historically structured, massive land masses, and their impact of globalization. And the second point, that when we're speaking about the long-lasting forms of great powers during the last 2,000 years, mainly we're speaking about forms of empires, not of forms of nation-states. So these countries, these ideas, that empire still could be alive within international relations system. It is highly important. So may you just provide a reflection on this point.
Okay. And you are Russian, of course.
I'm Ukrainian.
Are you Ukrainian? Oh, what a terrible... Are you Western Ukrainian or Eastern Ukrainian? That's the important thing. Oh, dear, dear. Well, you can see how civilization is extremely relevant. Any third question? Anyone else who'd like to ask something? No? Okay, well, then I will ask my question myself. And it's addressed to all our panelists. One of the most famous professors in the International Relations Department, certainly when I first came here, was Susan Strange. And she talked about the fact that there was no such thing as there was a civilization, it was a business civilization. It's Davos, essentially. She wrote this long before Davos. And Davos is basically what civilization is these days. And Robert Cox, who's also a well-known professor in international relations, talked about how people now have dual, if you're a businessman, you have dual civilizational ship. So you could be an Indian businessman or a Russian business or Ukrainian businessman or whatever, but you're also a businessman. And that's the business civilization is the important one. So we talked about political economy a bit on this panel. So my question is there really... do you believe in this concept of dual civilizational ship? And the people who spend most of their time in airport lounges and traveling around the world don't actually take the civilization stuff terribly seriously because they belong to a different civilization, which might be on a higher plane. So, Richard, let's start with you.
Interesting comments. Thank you, everybody, on the panel. I'll get a chance to say something to you about them all later, so I'll pick up from the audience rather than from you. Although I have to say, Adrian, I think you should be writing the next report, not me. You're much more advanced in where we're going than I am. Question on, I picked up five. These were ideal types. I could have had four. I could have had six. But you know what academics are like. They've got to have a list of things. But I think your question that was the interesting one is, can they exist exclusively of each other? Oh, sorry, do they exist exclusively of each other, or can they coexist? I think the answer is yes, they can coexist, and they'll coexist in different sets of ways. I mean, you know, we all like drawing matrices, for example, and one of the things I'm thinking about at the moment is how to put this into a matrix. But the question of the utility of the concept of empire, I think in part goes to some way to answer your question, because I could imagine how a couple of the categories that I identified could overlap in the idea of some form of thinking about empire as a concept. I mean, we're not going to think about empire in the way that we did at the time that the Brits had an empire or the French had an empire or whatever, but we will think in terms of, it's such an old concept, but not an irrelevant one. Spheres of influence, for example. I mean, if I think about Russia and its relationship with its former parts of the Soviet Union, I mean, it feels naked. It feels humiliated. I'm no specialist, but it seems to me that it's basically wants to reassert its control over a series. So the answer is yes, there is the prospect of coexistence. The idea that we would have a China century. Mabubani or Danny Quaro, that's never going to be a discrete activity in its own right, if indeed it does emerge. And I think it was you, Chris, who was talking about pluralism. It was your comments on deep pluralism. I thought that was good. So let me stop on that rather than rattle on. Let me just stand. I mean, Susan Strange, who many of you in the room are probably not old enough to remember, Susan used to say to me, "Richard, you're quite a smart boy. What are you wasting your time on all this trade nonsense for? Business civilizations are built around finance." And she genuinely, you know as well as I do, she believed that kind of line of argument. And it was always a case that she would never let a little bit of nuance interfere with the way she viewed the world.
To the tradition of the department, by the way.
I think the idea of people, what was it Theresa May said? You're a citizen of somewhere or you're a citizen of nowhere. I mean, as a Brit who is an Australian who lives in Budapest and Brussels, I found that deeply offensive that, that somehow I, so yes, I do believe that, that people can have multiple, identities. You know, you're never alone with schizophrenia. Sorry, that was not
That's very politically incorrect.
I know. I know. I just realized that as I said it. Please accept
me. Julius, please.
I'm not sure I have anything to say on this because I think Aaron is.
Could you say something about Modi and what has been happening in India recently? Since you are the only non-Western, non-white person on this
I was
panel.
Dreading this.
Yes, and I was dreading getting a question from the audience asking why that was the case. But anyway, please.
Just as background, I spent 23 years in the administration government in India. Not political government, but the bureaucratic government. So the question is about the civilizational element of the modern...
Modi Indian. Would like to turn India into a civilizational state. Hindutva. You know what we're talking about.
Zero.
Zero chance. Yeah. So the civilizational state, you would say, is only possible for authoritarian societies, but not for the non-authoritarian societies.
Not that. You have to arrive at a settled... belief, acceptance, understanding of the substance of what constitutes a civilizational perspective.
Yeah.
And I think India is nowhere near that. Assertions, strident statements, aggressive positions do not amount to a civilizational position. So can I pass it on?
No, please do. Let's pass the baton on to Aaron.
Aaron,
you come from Canada, which is certainly a civilizational state.
Neither a state nor a civilization.
Well, he's under his prime minister at the moment.
Right.
Sure.
So I've been so far. All right, three questions. Exclusive orders, the future. These are ideal types produced by academics. So in reality, it will be mixed. At a regional level, which I think is what you're interested in, we might have pockets of different things, but again, these are ideal types. So the answer is no, they're not exclusive in reality, but to a limit and within space and time. Second, empires. Right, so any superpower, great power in the modern system can have imperial tendencies in near-imperial structures. If we want to talk about civilization states and imperialism, that would be cultural imperialism, and that would be a case-by-case analysis. And can we have dual citizenship, civilizationalship at a global level? Perhaps we can. Can we all? Is I think, a better, harder question. Some of us can, but that's not good enough, is it? So we would like to have better meta-narratives at a global level. On question three.
Okay. Adrian.
So I think I would want to respond to the question about coexistence of orders or exclusivity by just saying I don't think we'll see a hegemony anytime soon. But I think the more interesting question is on what terms will any dialogue or engagement international geopolitics be conducted. And I suspect that it won't be on exclusively Western terms, but I also don't think that anything will easily replace Western grammar, partly because it's been exported so, you might say, successfully, often violently, or more recently through capitalism to all parts of the world, such that when we even think about who we are, we often think in very transactional terms, and that, of course, would be part and parcel of the Western, impoverished and reductive view of us as either commodities or administrative units, but not exactly very relational beings. So I think there may not be a geopolitical hegemony, but I think the terms on which dialogue will happen will probably still be residually Western. And when it comes to empires and nation states, I think it's worth pointing out that, again, nation states, in the way we understand that concept, is, you know, is a very Western and recent phenomenon. I mean, really only in existence since the end of the religious wars and the rise again of the Atlantic world. So I wouldn't want to suggest that nation states is as much of a universality. I think nationhood is far more universal and, of course, can be traced back many centuries and millennia. But I don't think we should ever make the mistake of saying that nationhood is the same as nation state. I don't think one can or should indeed eradicate national identity, but I don't think national identity is always and best expressed in terms of nation, in terms of nation states, partly because a lot of countries around the world are multinational, and therefore the idea of a single state to represent all those nations may not really work so well. But I think, again, more fundamentally here is the question of the civilizing mission of countries, be they nation states or empires. And I think that's what's interesting now, that perhaps there's a greater contest around the civilizing mission. It's no longer a Western monopoly, and it probably only was for the Cold War. But on Christopher's question around the dual civilization, I'm almost sort of tempted to say that some of those elites that you were describing, Christopher, lack much cultural or civilization and really behave in entirely self-serving ways. But I don't want to leave it at that, because I think that would be misleading, not least because it would pander to the sort of discourse about, oh, you know, all elites are corrupt and we just need the will of the people, if somehow that was monolithic and inherently superior and more civilized. No, I think the question is today how to foster more virtuous elites at all levels of society. People can be leaders in one respect and followers in another, but also much greater popular participation in power and wealth. Because I think that's really the problem. It's not going to be a choice of elites versus the people, because the very people who made that argument, the so-called populists, are themselves, of course, entirely part of the elite. You know, the likes of Farage and others are not exactly outsiders, and certainly not the left behind. So I think I want to get away from that sort of misleading binary, and I think it's much more a question of good elites and greater popular sharing of power and wealth.
Thank you very much. Unfortunately, our time has largely come to an end, and we have to let our speakers go off to their dinner, which would be very uncivilized if we didn't do that. I just make two points, if I may. First of all, dialogue of civilizations. What is this about? It started in the 1990s with Havel, the president of the Czech Republic, and Khatami in Iran. And the idea was to counter the narrative of the clash of civilizations by Samuel Huntington. But just to remind you that Samuel Huntington's book is still the most important book that has been published in international relations in the last 30 years. It's been translated into 60 languages, and there are many people who take that argument very seriously indeed. And so we should all take it seriously. You should read it. If you wish to dispute it, you have to read it first. The second thing I would say is that things are going to change. And the best way of illustrating that is go back to the Beijing Olympic Games in 2008. You remember when the athletes came into the stadium? In every Olympic Games until Beijing in 2008, they came in alphabetical order, because the West, of course, has an alphabet. Chinese language doesn't have an alphabet. And the Chinese did not bring them in alphabetical order. They brought them the order of brush strokes in Chinese calligraphy. That was, in a sense, a shot across the brows. Things are going to change now. And what Martin Jakes calls Euro-provincialism, the idea that the West has basically made history for the last 300 years and everything is Western, from the alphabet to everything else, that is going to come, I think, to an end, for good or bad. And the third, last point I would make, it's the point that Richard touched upon, and which also Adrian is very interested in, and Aaron as well, which is about universal values and value pluralism. Because we're now at this point in time where we're discussing whether human rights, for example, which is perhaps the quintessential set of Western values,
in the last 200 years, whether they exist or not, or whether different civilizations have different value systems. And that doesn't actually mean that you can't coexist. It means that they have a view of what human rights should be, which is not necessarily what West thinks about human rights. That debate has just begun. And if we don't have this dialogue of civilizations, then I think we go back, and this is my very last point, I've released you back into the community. The last point I would make is we have what Ian Bremmer, the Eurasia Group, calls a G0 world. This is a world without global governance. This is a world without NGOs. This is a world without universal values, where deals are struck, the art of the deal, if you like, which we had in the 19th century. And it worked pretty well in the 19th century, except it ended in war. Are we going back to that period? And I think the dialogue of civilizations is basically about avoiding a G0 world and finding different people whose voices have been basically silenced through history, by Western historians of the last 300 years, finally getting their voice, but being able to put together some kind of universal value system, which will be very different from the value system we have at the moment. But I think you'll agree that we've had a wonderful set of speakers, and I would like to thank you very much, particularly on a Friday evening, for coming along.
Yeah.
It is amazing.
Yeah.
Please thank our speakers.